And now let's visit a country that is just emerging from decades of being shunned by the West. That country is Myanmar. After years of economic sanctions, people there are ready to start enjoying the technological advances the rest of the world has. NPR's Robert Smith from our Planet Money team profiles one young man trying to build an internet startup in a place where there's not much internet.
He acts like a proud father. Naeong opens up his MacBook Air to show me his baby. His Myanmar travel website.
Wait, one second. Yeah.
Ooh, it says network error.
Something's going on today.
Okay, if Nate could pull up the website, I would see something pretty amazing for a poor country like Myanmar. It's called Owe, a travel site, like Expedia. It lets people around the world reserve rooms in small hotels all across Myanmar. You can book flights to towns that weren't even on the grid a few years ago. Frankly, they're barely on the grid now.
Now, just to make this clear, we've been waiting 30 seconds for your site to come up.
Today is a particularly very bad day for internet.
This is life in Myanmar right now. Even an internet entrepreneur can't always get online. Naeong was born and grew up here, back when it was known as Burma. But his internet chops come from the U.S. He got his MBA at Stanford, worked at Google, still has the stylish haircut, Ralph Lauren shirts. When he saw that Myanmar was opening up, he moved back a year and a half ago. Nay was convinced that travel would be the first big business to boom in the new Myanmar, and he approached investors in Asia and the United States.
What was their first question? Where is Myanmar?
Oh, literally, they've been asked before, you know. So they literally brought in a huge map, and they asked me to point out where Myanmar is.
See China? See India? It's right in the middle.
Exactly, right?
Nay got some venture capitalists interested. He hired web developers in India, put the servers in Singapore. Typical stuff for an internet startup. The hard part, though, was that he had to convince hotels in Myanmar that they needed to be on the internet. See, a lot of hotels in the country are mom-and-pop affairs. They do their reservations on paper. They only use cash.
They don't even have bank accounts, right?
And they're hotels.
They're hotels, exactly.
In order to make the website work, Nay had to pull off a pretty neat trick. He needed to be the middleman between the two different worlds, high-tech and no-tech. For instance, when I was at the main office, I saw an order from Germany for 6 nights at a local hotel in Yangon. The German paid with a credit card on the website. Now, that money went halfway around the world in the blink of an eye, but it can't get all the way to the hotel. You see, here Nay faces a classic challenge that entrepreneurs have in almost all developing countries. Whoever goes first has to figure everything out, like how to get money from the international banking system to hotels that do business like they did 50 years ago. Nay's solution? He goes to a lockbox next to his desk, pulls out a bunch of cash, U.S. $20 bills to be exact, and he entrusts that cash to the final step in the money's global journey, a 23-year-old employee named Sign Co. Sign goes outside with the money and gets on a city bus. It takes about 40 hot, crowded minutes for Sign and me to get all the way across town. And when we get to the hotel, this high-tech internet transaction ends up in a three-ring binder. Then, of course, I see why they still rely on paper.
Whoa, the power just went out.
Back at the office, the Owe website is up and running nicely.
So this is essentially, you know, what the site looked like. So in terms
it looks
of
nice.
And it's getting some traction. About 500 bookings a month so far, and growing. Nay says right now only a tiny percentage of the population of Myanmar has access to the internet. He wants to be there when the rest get online. Still, I gotta ask him.
Do you ever think that it's too soon to start an internet business in a country that doesn't really have payments and a telecommunications infrastructure? Like, maybe you came back too soon.
Yeah. So, I mean, I thought about a lot, right, when I first came, right? You could never get the timing right.
But then Nay pauses and pulls out a very Silicon Valley reason for why people go to all the trouble to be the first.
So now I think we are finding ourselves as one of the leading, you know, brands, you know, in this space, right? Because you don't technically have a lot of brands in the first place.
Yeah, so, you don't have a lot of competitors.
Exactly, right?
Of course, getting in early in a country like Myanmar has its downside, too. If you do such a good job of solving all the problems, you've made it that much easier for the competition to follow you. Robert Smith, NPR News.
The popular series Arrested Development returns this Sunday with 15 new episodes, released all at once. They're coming from Netflix, which earlier this year released House of Cards. Online video companies are producing more of their own shows, not just Netflix. Hulu and Yahoo are getting into the act as well. Now, Amazon also wants to join, but they're doing things differently, letting viewers help choose the new lineup. Here's what TV critic Eric Deggans thinks of that approach.
It's the most pressing question of the moment for modern television. What will be the definitive TV show made for the internet?
We need a hit. We need a story that is so enticing.
Amazon Prime subscribers can now sift through pilot episodes of 14 series starring John Goodman, Baby Newirth, and Jeffrey Tambor.
Listen up, you fleshy little sack of corn syrup and Cheeto grease. That's not going to work on this worm.
Customers note in the review sections what they think. It's a crowdsourcing setup with more than a whiff of 21st century cool. But the pilots just aren't groundbreaking enough. The whole arrangement looks more innovative than it truly is.
That sounds pretty last election cycle to me there, Lewis.
It's looking good for Alpha House, a comedy from Doonesbury creator Gary Trudeau about GOP senators who bunk together in a house in D.C. But it turns out this show's most remarkable moment belongs to Bill Murray. Here, John Goodman wakes him up because he's overslept for a very important appointment.
Vernon! Were you by any chance scheduled to turn yourself in at the DOJ this morning?
Oh, no!
If you couldn't tell after we cleaned it up for public radio, no one slings a four-letter word like Bill Murray. But minus the cursing and occasional nudity, none of Amazon's eight new comedies are much bolder than your average basic cable series. In fact, the four-letter words here feel like a dodge. They're trying to make conventional fare seem more daring. That's what trips up this musical number from Baby Newirth's comedy Browsers.
I'm someone who makes up new rules every day.
She plays a proudly profane, Arianna Huffington-style website owner.
For instance, the rule that it sounds déclassé to say I'm not someone to f*** with.
F-word or not, this feels too much like a bad Saturday Night Live skit. Maybe that's why there's already rumors it won't be picked up. But the most controversial show here is probably an animated series featuring two homegirl divas who work in a mall by day and pursue Indiana Jones-style adventures on the side. It's called, of course, Supernatural.
You know what? This is the 49th time we say the word. At 50, we should throw a party.
I'm all about a party, but technically this is still only 48.
We deserve a party up in here.
So I'm wondering, is this a 21st century minstrel show or just an Adult Swim cartoon gone bad? What Amazon hasn't said yet is exactly how public feedback will help them pick shows or when they'll confirm which shows get made in a series. Think back on recent history, and there's a handful of TV programs that define their new medium. HBO's The Sopranos and Sex and the City reset the culture for what you could do with an original premium cable show. FX's The Shield and AMC's Mad Men proved you could bring those kinds of complex characters to standard cable. And Netflix's House of Cards is making the same argument for streaming video. Amazon's got to do more than sling a few F-words before they accomplish anything similar. But if you have any ideas on how they can get there, I hear they're taking suggestions.
Eric Deggans is TV and media critic for the Tampa Bay Times. To other news now, Hulu is on the auction block. A number of companies and investors are vying to buy the popular video streaming site, which features shows like Family Guy and Saturday Night Live. NPR's Dan Bobkoff has more.
There are two ways Hulu could go. It could be the future of television, watching the shows you want when you want them, or it could just end up a supplement to the traditional cable television we've had for years. Which path it takes depends on who buys Hulu. Time Warner Cable and DirecTV are among those said to be competing. Conceivably, either could bundle Hulu with their TV packages, making it less appealing to those who have canceled cable. On the other side, Yahoo is reportedly interested as well. It's looking to compete with Google, which owns YouTube. Bids have also come in from private equity firms, including Providence Equity, which is backing an offer from a former News Corporation executive. Brett Sappington is with the market research firm Parks Associates.
Depending on who acquires it, that could change the type of content that Hulu specializes in. It could also change the balance of what content is free and what content is paid for.
Some shows on Hulu are free, but paid subscribers get access to more programming. Hulu is currently controlled by the News Corporation, which owns Fox, and the Walt Disney Company. Comcast also has a stake. Hulu won't say if it's profitable, but it generated nearly $700 million in revenue last year. It has 4 million paid subscribers and is among the 15 most popular websites. Dan Bobkoff, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. And now, All Tech Considered. There's an article in the May 27th issue of The New Yorker called Change the World: Silicon Valley Transfers Its Slogans and Its Money to the Realm of Politics. In it, The New Yorker's George Packer writes about, among other things, technological optimism, the sort of thinking that led Mark Zuckerberg to remark a few years ago that widespread use of Facebook in Lebanon could help young people feel more connected and perhaps less likely to embrace terrorism. George Packer writes this: "Technology can be an answer to incompetence and inefficiency, but it has little to say about larger issues of justice and fairness unless you think that political problems are bugs that can be fixed by engineering rather than fundamental conflicts of interest and value." And he joins us now from Brooklyn. George Packer, welcome once again.
Good to be back with you, Robert.
Are we now seeing a huge amount of money and political influence coming from people who are very rich, very self-interested, very smart, and very much convinced that their interests are our interests?
Yeah, what I found in Silicon Valley is an industry that's sort of been kept a very far removed from Washington and had an attitude of just let us do our thing and make the miracles that people love around the world and leave us alone. And I think the industry has gotten big enough, wealthy enough, and entangled in our lives enough that some of the leaders out there began to realize they can't completely ignore politics. They have to pay attention to it. They need lobbyists in Washington. Mark Zuckerberg has started an advocacy group for immigration reform. And there's even a line of thinking out there that technology holds a lot of the answers to what ails government.
As for the phrase that's the title of your article, Change the World, when I hear it, I associate Barack Obama saying as much. It reminds me, years ago, Jimmy Carter said that we just needed a government as good as we are. And Bill Clinton used to declare every profound political conflict a case of false choices at some level. But we've always had a certain amount of simplistic, optimistic bromides from people in public life. Is this one any different?
I think it's very much in that lineage. It's sort of populist. It's magical thinking. It's ahistorical in the sense that it really doesn't take recent history seriously. Instead, it thinks that a whole new way of doing things, such as transferring engineering solutions to political problems, using the iPhone to improve, you know, city services and the problems of urban government, that's very much the same kind of magical thinking that I think Barack Obama's 2008 campaign somewhat suffered from, and the other politicians that you named. It seems to be a regular temptation in an era where people feel that government doesn't work very well. If we just kind of get out of that box and into another one, or out of all boxes, somehow that will solve the problem.
You write, after hearing the praises sung of apps that can hail us a taxi and pick us a restaurant and order a bike messenger to deliver takeout, quote, "It suddenly occurred to me that the hottest tech startups are solving all the problems of being 20 years old with cash on hand, because that's who thinks them up."
Yeah, that's a little bit of an unfair quip, since, of course, there's a lot else going on in Silicon Valley, including some, you know, pretty amazing engineering breakthroughs. But I did get the feeling, especially in San Francisco, where south of Market Street, there's just thousands, it seems, of little startup companies that are the next social network or the next sharing economy breakthrough. Their vision of what life should be like in its frictionless, seamless version, which is a phrase as you hear often out there, is the life of 20-somethings, people, you know, without kids, without jobs that involve a fair amount of drudgery. It's like the real problem is, how do you get your food to your apartment as fast as possible? So it was perhaps not entirely justified, but I couldn't resist it.
You know, thinking about the political views of the folks in Silicon Valley, as you write about them, I was thinking about Henry Ford, who was an ingenious industrialist of his day, who held many very odious views, but he also believed in paying auto workers a wage that would permit them to buy the cars they were making. There's a certain egalitarianism involved in what he was doing. That doesn't seem to figure at all in this particular worldview.
Right. These are very unodious people. These are very good people, nice people, people you like to talk to and be around, and who, if they did have workers, would probably pay them pretty well because they distribute their stock options quite fairly. But they don't have any workers. That's the problem. The working class of San Francisco and the Bay Area is being pushed out of its old neighborhoods because of the skyrocketing cost of housing. And there's no real working class left because these are jobs for engineers and managers and designers, very smart people. A lot of them come from Ivy League colleges. And San Francisco and Silicon Valley are more and more being shaped after their desires and their idea of the good life.
Is this story also, is it equally about the naivete of people who think that Silicon Valley millionaires are different, or is it only about the peculiar views of those people themselves?
No, I think you're right. It is about the country's attitude toward Silicon Valley and its leaders, which is to say they're not quite seen as just corporate heads or as industry titans. They're seen as pioneers, revolutionaries even. Steve Jobs very much encouraged that. And so, for example, last week when Tim Cook, who replaced Jobs as the CEO of Apple, appeared before the Senate to try to explain Apple's extremely creative means for avoiding paying corporate taxes in the U.S., by the end, the senator seemed to be racing to shake his hand and tell him how much they loved Apple's products, which tells me Apple isn't like the oil and gas industry, isn't like the pharmaceutical industry. They are considered somehow higher than that. And I think that's a dangerous attitude because, after all, Apple was found to be one of the biggest tax avoiders in the country today. And that's something that should not be waved away simply because senators have wonderful iPhones in their pockets that they stare at all the time.
George Packer's article in the May 27th New Yorker is called Change the World. He's also the author of the new book, The Unwinding. George Packer, thanks a lot for talking with us.
My pleasure, Robert.
We've asked you to send us stories about the vintage sounds of technology you miss, and we've been listening to those stories on All Things Considered. Today, Scott Smith of Duncan, South Carolina, with the help of his own vintage sound collection, tells us about something he recalls first hearing when he was a small child.
I can remember I fell in love with the startup sound of an electromechanical pinball machine, oh, when I was 3 or 4 years old. We're with family in my grandparents' hometown of Lancaster, South Carolina, and we walked into a department store there, and there stood this big wooden box. There was a man standing there playing it, of course. So I cried a little bit and finally convinced my dad to put me up into a grocery buggy where I could stand and watch, and I was mesmerized. Over the years, that love grew, and every summer when we'd take our vacations up to the mountains of North Carolina, there was a little arcade right near the house where we stayed, and I would beg for quarters and play pinball and play pinball and play pinball and got pretty good at it. I can remember one day going to church. We sat down front for the children's sermon, and the pastor was trying to get us to understand the value of money and putting that money, when we earn it, into the offering plate on Sunday. So he came along and asked us, what would we do with a quarter? And so other people said various things, and he got to little Scott, and little Scott said, I would play a game of pinball.
Listener and no longer little Scott Smith of Duncan, South Carolina. Those sounds come from his collection of old pinball machines that he loved as a child.
Now, for people who enjoy using technology, it might feel like there's an app for everything. Some are mindless. I mean, I'm a little embarrassed to tell you how much time I spend baking fake pizza on my mobile device. Then there are apps that are meant to actually be productive, and let's hear about one of those now. In San Francisco, a group of software developers formed a nonprofit called Code for America. They're developing apps to help cities function better for their citizens. This year, the organization is working in 9 cities around the U.S. Laura Ziegler of member station KCUR reports on what Code for America is doing for Kansas City.
Andrew Heider is a 31-year-old urban planner who's one of 3 Code for America fellows in Kansas City for the year. I caught up with him at a hackathon, an all-night gathering of like-minded young people who come together to brainstorm and write code or software. hence the name Code for America. His Twitter handle, Hack Your City, reflects the communal ethos around here that hacking now has a positive connotation.
You take a system and maybe break it apart and find what pieces you could build for cheaper or easier, and then you put it back together in this new form that it's helped everyone out. You've left it better than you found it.
And that's what Code for America fellows are trying to do. They're working on criminal justice systems in New York and Louisville, and in San Francisco and San Mateo on health and human services. In the Kansas City area, the fellows are looking at ways to spur economic development.
You'd never know, looking at these new wooden brick townhomes across 5th Street in the heart of Kansas City, Kansas, that the block was once blighted homes and drug houses. The other thing you would never know is that it took John Harvey and his nonprofit redevelopment group, City Vision, days, weeks, even months to penetrate the bureaucracy to begin to get this work done.
John Harvey says no commercial real estate company is ever going to jump through the same hoops as City Vision, whose mission it is to clean up bad neighborhoods.
I mean, just to figure out the ownership and get control of the property, you may have to go to the Register of Deeds, you may have to go to the Tax Delinquent Real Estate Office, you might have to go to the Treasurer's Office, all just to get a hold of the property.
Harvey says with an app like the one Code for America is working on, he could retrieve all that information in one place online in a matter of minutes. Fellows in the Kansas City area are hoping their web-based product will reach beyond urban renewal to nothing less than a sweeping new relationship between citizens and their government. The hope is it will extend not only to the energetic startup internet community here, but small businesses across the board. Hyder and his colleague Ariel Cannon rolled out the first version of their app for some city officials and community leaders late last month. It's a how-to manual for civic engagement, says Cannon.
There would be a variety of lessons that you could go ahead and engage with. So it could be promote your business online, pay your taxes online.
Gwendolyn Thomas is a city employee, and she has some concerns. She fields calls to the non-emergency helpline in the Kansas City, Kansas mayor's office.
You know, it may work for some of our younger adults in the community, but we get a lot of calls from our seniors, and so they're not computer knowledgeable. You know, they don't have those tools.
I'm working till like midnight.
Back at the hackathon, you hear the word iteration a lot. That's hackeries for changes. Hyder says the fellows will continue tweaking the technology, making it easier to understand and more accessible. But the technology itself, he says, is not the biggest challenge.
Keeping people engaged using these types of technology in the right way to ask questions and actually get valuable feedback, using it is the harder part.
The Code for America fellows will leave Kansas City in November, but the organization plans to leave its footprint here with something called the Brigade. It's a group of local volunteers who will continue helping citizens engage with city government online. For NPR News, I'm Laura Ziegler in Kansas City.